first by the shoulders, and then wraps her in her arms. Her body is rigid. There is panic in its every fibre. "I think not," says Mrs. Frost gently. "He will not help us any more. He is gone." Angelica clings to her for a short while, and then breaks free, shaking herself down. "Well, then," she says with resolve, "if you do not want me to go to prison, you will help me." "Surely there's somebody you can appeal to," says Mrs. Frost.
"Who, Eliza? I have no admirers left. I have given my attention to no one else. And now I..."
Her voice trembles and she gasps, but does not sob.
"And now I am back where I began," she finishes. "Only a good deal stouter. And the line on my forehead is there all the time, and not only when I frown. I know how it goes when a woman my age is abandoned. The bailiffs come, and she must needs return to the nunnery to open her legs. And the men she gets are of less and less consequence each year that she ages until she's quite abandoned and ruined, ruined, ruined. Oh, Eliza, that cannot be my fate. Not so soon. I feel no older than 15. How have I come to this?"
"It may not be as bad as you think," says Mrs. Frost with distaste. "If I take these things away, it will be in the faithful hope that we shall have it all back a month from now." She is glad to see Angelica brought to her knees. It makes her feel far softer towards her. She is moved again to touch her. She smooths her friend's shoulders. "All will be well," she says. "You are young yet. You are beautiful." Angelica knuckles her forehead.
"I fear I have misstepped. I'm 27. If I were to have peaked, should I not have done so by now? Indeed, I was on a good trajectory. To have followed the Duke with Rockingham, to have so misplayed my hand when I was most desirable. Oh, I'm a fool."
Mrs. Frost, however vindicated she may feel, betrays nothing of that.
"That young whelp is no one at all. An aberration you will recover from. The whole affair will be forgotten in 6 months. You will climb yet, I'm certain."
Angelica tries to smile.
"Thank you, my dear friend, my truest friend."
"I hope I shall always be so."
A thought strikes her.
"I shall send for Mrs. Chapel."
"Oh!"
Angelica feels in sore need of a mother. Any sort will do. But she knits her brow.
"No,"
she says.
"What a stupid idea. As if I would want her to see what has befallen me."
"Perhaps she may help.
Perhaps she may dance a gavotte." "Certainly not. The thing to do is to make as little of this episode as possible. So he is tired of me. What do I care? Let the world see it makes no great difference to me."
She begins to survey the room more coolly and rifles its contents for value with her eyes alone.
"After all, there is no need to strip the place bare," she says. "I shall be in need of a certain level of splendour for my entertaining."
Her voice again falters with a new burst of shame.
"Only take these jewels I've set aside, Eliza. They are of the greatest value. Go back to the jeweller and tell them I'm displeased. The quality is not what I'd been promised. Demand that they return what I paid."
"But there is nothing amiss with them."
"Better something amiss with the jewels than with me. I need the money. That might settle whichever bills come in first. Then we shall see what steps must be taken. And, oh!"
She reaches up to her throat and unpins the twinkling dart from her fichu. Her hands tremble, and she cannot look Mrs. Frost in the eye as she turns Rockingham's first love token over to her.
"See what you can get for this."
Her voice cracks and gives out. Mrs. Frost has the decency to take the pin without a word and quits the room as Angelica lowers herself onto her sofa and perches, trembling there, as if it were already no longer hers. She traces the place on its arm where an entire glass of ratafia was upturned.
"I'm not ruined. Never ruined," she assures herself. "There's always a way through."
Chapter 21. The alley is not 3 feet wide, and within it that air peculiar to the rookeries, cold, certainly, but palpably damp, and a vegetable-ish smell to it, as if the hand of a drowned man had been placed across one's nose and mouth. There are other smells, too. First the smoky runnels of old piss, then a dark, foul scent of things rotting, unknown and unseen. Polly cannot think whether she is grateful for the concealing darkness or not. Were it better to not see what dreadfulness lies so close to one? Behind her, the breath of this man who has claimed her next 10 minutes. She is glad not to look upon him, some journeyman carpenter who stared at her coldly when she asked him the questions Mrs. Chapel taught her.
"Flatter a man with conversation. Engage first his intellect. It will make you all the greater a prize. Any girl can fuck. That is not what he comes to you for."
"Here,"
he says in the darkness, and no more.
"Oh, but, sir, I've a room just this way. Would you not prefer a bed and a glass of something? I shall sing for you." She trails off.
"What, and have you robbed me? I know your sort."
He presses her up against the wall, and she shrieks before she can help herself. He claps his hand over her mouth as she begins to tremble, whispers,
"No, please, do not hurt me,"
and bridles away with a cowering curl of the lip, which is her best attempt at a smile.
"Forgive me," she whispers. "Forgive me."
His breath reeks so strongly of decay, it were as if his mouth were a meat safe that some sluttish housewife had abandoned a flitch of bacon within.
"Command, first of all, his admiration, and second of all, his appreciation. Never let him forget what a rare and valuable item you are. Display yourself to your best. You are an envoy of Venus herself, and he cannot enter the temple without your first beckoning him in."
She need not conceal her own disgust, which on the one hand is a mercy, on the other, at Mrs. Chapel's she never had so much disgust to mask, for not only does this man's mouth smell, but his clothes do as well, of stagnant water and sour milk, gravy splattered from the crust of a pie, and his own dreadful odour of an animal lived too long in one small space, turning around and around in its own sweat and filth. The wall is lichenous and wet against the back of her head. She has lost count of how many men she has taken in this way, with a sort of numbed horror, thinking each time, "This will be the last one." But the coins are like elf money, which vanishes from her hand not hours after she has earned it for the sake of her daily needs. Bread crusts, candle stubs, gin, and it is all gone again, and she forced back onto the street for another round. How quickly it has become routine for her. Hitching up her skirt, she thinks, "This must change." Simeon's note remains in her pocket, although she had determined not to look at it again. "After tonight, I shall go out of the city at once. I am too easy to find here." He is unbuckling his trousers, and she makes to guide him, but he pushes her hand away, and bracing one elbow across her chest, presses himself upon her. He holds her so hard against the wall that she thinks he will do her a mischief. his arm holding her shoulders too far back, bruising, she thinks, her breastbone. When she wriggles to seek greater comfort for herself, he curses and holds her tighter. Her head knocks against the wall behind her as he fucks. She would raise an arm to cushion behind it, but cannot risk his patience.
"And will it not be done in a trice?" she says to herself. "And then the sixpence will be my own."
And so she remains there, the back of her head bumping the wall, wondering how this all has come to be. When she walked from Mrs. Chapel's care, it was as if she, all unknowing, passed through a door into a world that, although it is like London, is nothing at all like London, and its natives nothing at all like the Londoners she knew before. Some bewitchment, she thinks, a glamour. The man is pounding at her faster now. She hears his teeth click with a determination and the breath all rough in his throat. He has seen his quarry, and he is closing in on it.
Or perhaps,
and this thought comes to her with some surprise, it was my old life that was the glamour. Feather beds and courteous gentlemen, hot milk for breakfast, riches beyond riches, there for the taking. How can that have been real? How could I have credited such good fortune? When he is done, she walks alone up the alley. Her knees feel wobbly and her sex hot and smarting. His leavings trickle down the inside of her thigh, warm at first, but cold where the air begins to touch it. She stops to mop herself with her petticoats, and stooping, smells the roe and fungus fug of strange men spending, all crusting in the folds of her silver-spangled gown.
Perhaps I shall hang for this, she thinks. The petticoats alone, worth 15 shillings. Milk for breakfast. I must have been dreaming.
And her stomach rumbles. She stops to lean against the wall, bending as if she would vomit. But she only spits, and closes her eyes against the spinning world. To comfort herself, she reaches through her skirt and into the pocket that hangs upon her bare hip, to touch once again the scrap of paper that bears Simeon's neat hand. She had not thought to make use of it. But now, brought low, the mere kindness of his intentions is a balm to her, and she draws it forth, although it is too dark to make out those small and crooked letters of his.
Does he think of me? She wonders, pulling her scanty shawl about herself.
And then, as she returns to her place on the street, shaking out her shimmering skirts,
is now the moment I go on to the place he directs me?
Ah, how many worlds there are contained upon the earth, and how many will she pass through before she reaches the next? Chapter 22. A week later, a remarkable letter is delivered to Mr. Hancock's office, which has travelled by stage all the way from Oban. He tears it open, all unsuspecting, to find the flamboyant hand of Tiso Jones unfurling like creeping ivy all over the page. It reads,
"Dear friend, wonder of wonders! Forgive me if I do not stand on ceremony, but I have such marvellous things to tell you that I cannot think how to begin this letter. I would prefer to plunge immediately into my story. Would you not prefer this also? I made inquiries and befriended the crew of a whaling ship far north of the Scottish Isles, and on my third day out with them, we came upon a true mermaid. She had been caught up in the nets of a fishing boat, which mistook her at first for a school of herring, so vast and glinting was she. They hauled her aboard all silver and shining, but no sooner had they done so than she burst the net and sprang out again. They catching her once more, she shrieked up and down the bay like a mistral, dragging the boat behind her, and she continued in this manner all through the night, until finally At dawn she was exhausted. She is very large and fine, and nothing indeed like you have ever seen in your life. And yet there's no mistaking what she is. Yours, Captain Tiso Jones.
He thinks for a moment that he may faint, but then he recovers himself. He does not stop to put on his hat or file away his letters or check his diary. He simply rises from his chair, pulls on his coat, and leaves the office. He has never walked so fast in his life. He ought to hail a hansom, but it would save no time. The roads are crammed as ever. Instead, he weaves between wagons and sedan chairs and yoked milkmaids, trotting so vigorously he fears his heart will burst. He is taken unawares by a half-wild pigling, a lean little thing with coarse black hair, which gallops from a yard and into his knee. Its weight sends him reeling, and he staggers at the burst of pain. But the pig goes on, shrieking hoarsely, leaving a smear of something foul on his breeches. At Dean Street, he seeks out Angelica's door, raising his stick to rap against it. But something is wrong. The door stands ajar, and from within emanates some sort of commotion, the pattering, it seems, of anxious feet, raised voices. He pushes the door open and steps into the little panelled hall. Nobody there, not even the sharp-faced Mrs. Frost, usually so officious about what visitors make their way up the stairs. He stands for a moment and listens. The running noise again, coming from overhead, and Angelica's voice cracked and hysterical.
"Oh, what shall I do? What am I to do?"
"Calm yourself," comes Mrs. Frost's voice, quite as shrill as Angelica's.
"But he told me he loved me. He gave me his word."
"And you did not secure an agreement. Now that was careless," says another voice, quite calm.
Mr. Hancock recognizes it as that of Mrs. Chapel. A flurry of sobs, and Mr. Hancock can hold back no longer. He hurries up the stairs. When he enters Angelica's parlour, he finds it almost empty of furniture. The sofa is gone, and the wardrobes, the writing table, the glasses, the golden mouse cage, all vanished away. In its newly emptied state, the room has a strange quality of sound in it, a hollow ringing. Here and there are little heaps of debris, crumpled dresses, piles of books, and Mrs. Frost scuttles hither and thither, cramming what she may of each heap into a large sack. In the centre of the room stands Mrs. Chapel, hands on doughty hips, looking down with distaste at Mrs. Angelica Neal, who kneels at her feet in pitiful supplication. Her curls are knotted and wilting, and her chintz wrap falls open to reveal merely a chemise beneath it. Mr. Hancock has never seen her in her loose clothes before. He tries not to stare, but he can see the outline of her bosom and her buttocks quite plainly through the thin fabric.
"Oh, Mrs. Chapel! Dear Mrs. Chapel!"
Angelica weeps.
"Take me back to King's Place. I'll give you everything I earn. I won't begrudge you a penny. I'll teach the girls for you anything, anything. Only save me from penury."
"I have no space for you."
Angelica embarks on a fresh bout of sobs and wraps her arms around Mrs. Chapel's calves.
"Save me," she whimpers. "You're the closest thing I ever had to a mother."
"Oh, spare me," the bawd snaps, shaking her off. "Even if I were your mother, you've exhausted my patience. No, you have let me down too often. You've been petulant and unreliable. I cannot have you in my house. Every man knows you spend twice what he can lay on you. I am only here to choose what of your effects I might take for myself, which will go some way, only some way, towards recompensing me for the money I laid on you. This is the last favour I will do for you.
The money?
Asks Angelica.
But we're all settled. The Duke, he bought me out.
The money I donated to support you these last few months, since Mr. Rockingham could not.
But I do not... Eliza?
Angelica turns to her.
We needed it,
says Mrs. Frost helplessly.
What could I do?
You accepted money from her?
And Angelica is quaking, her wrists and elbows gone to jelly, so that she subsides onto the floorboards.
Oh, Eliza! How could you have done it?
With remarkable few scruples,
Mrs. Chapel interjects with relish.
And you owe me £125, so you will appreciate my desire for recompense.
She shuffles into the bedroom, Mrs. Frost close behind her. Angelica's shoulders heave. She lowers her face to the floor and rests her brow there as if she were a Mussulman at prayer. And indeed, she whispers,
Oh God! Oh God! What is to be done?
At last, Mr. Hancock ventures.
What has happened here?
Angelica's head whips up. Her face is damp and blotchy, her eyes very swollen.
Sir? Mr. Hancock?
She stammers, wiping her nose on the back of her wrist. She tries to smile and gabbles.
Mr. Jonah Hancock, the mermaid man. I was not expecting you.
What is afoot?
She rises to her knees, hunting about for her handkerchief.
To be frank, sir, I believe I am ruined.
She pats her face, then ventures a laugh. Mucus is trailing from her nose. She snatches it into her fist, but more runs, and then her eyes fill up again.
I have been abandoned by a most inconstant friend, and consequently my rent has gone unpaid, and I have creditors all over town that I knew nothing of until this week. Even Mrs. Chapel.
She stops to gulp breath like a landed mackerel.
Even she has contributed to my penury. Even Eliza, they've hurled me into the jaws of my debtors. They offer me no assistance.
Oh, he dithers in the doorway. From the bedroom can be heard those two ladies picking over what belongings remain.
There's a better bolster than that, comes Mrs. Frost's voice. You see? That one has a mend to it. But let me see, I believe there is another drawer of linen that may be of use to you.
There,
scowls Angelica, wiping her nose on a fistful of her own skirts.
What do you think of that? I might be dead, the vultures. They waste no time.
Perhaps it were better if I left, he says.
Her raw, swimming eyes are fixed on her hands, which she clasps in her lap.
No question of it,
she sighs. He retreats onto the landing. Within, he hears the soft slump of her collapsing back to the floorboards, and then a string of half-suppressed sobs. He wrings his hands, agonizes in the unlit passage. Then he returns softly to her parlour. He crouches down beside her and presses his own handkerchief, large and coarse as a sail, into her small fist.
But who will look after you?
He asks. She shrugs, her face quite buried in the folds of cloth.
I shall fare quite well, she says. There will be a way.
You mean there is nobody?
Look about yourself.
She says,
Do you see any kind helper here? No. Rats from a sinking ship, sir. Even my faithful toad-eater Frost has abandoned me.
And what of your debts? Who pays those?
Who but I myself?
But you have no means to do so.
Then I shall go to prison.
He is a pecunious man. This is what it comes down to. The very word debt strikes cold fear into his bones. It is a black spot, a curse, a dreadful reckoning. No man could hold his head up after being ruined, with everybody knowing what a judgment that was on him. Only death itself could be worse, and that by a slim margin. But it is not her fault. She has fallen out of the order of things, and the network of wages and inheritance that ought to keep her safe has failed her.
"I shall pay your bills," he says.
She blows her nose fruitily.
"You will?"
She nestles up against him, resting her head on his shoulder. When he puts his arm around her, he feels again the delightful softness of her body, now freed from its stays.
"My debts are very large, sir. It was hardly of my doing."
"It don't signify. I can pay."
She turns her wet face up to his. She is presently unlovely, it is true, but the redness about her eyes brings up the sharp blue of her irids.
"Why would you do it?" she asks.
Because it is obscene to him for a person to be ruined twice over. And if he may put right this imbalance in the world, it were all to the good.
"Ah," he says, "I have found you a mermaid."
"A mermaid?"
she scoffs, dabbing at her eyes and hiccuping with the last of her tears.
"You have done no such thing."
"I have."
He pulls out the letter, and she frowns to read it in haste while he rhapsodizes.
"It is a sign. Two mermaids in one lifetime. What do you reckon the odds to be on such a thing?"
"It sounds an utter nonsense," she snorts. "What is this gibberidge he's written? I expect when it arrives it is no more than a little dead monkey like the one she rented from you, and which brought us to all this."
"No, no, nothing like that."
Although he can barely credit it. A living mermaid, slick as a fish, strong as a whale. No grotesque mockery, but the beast of London's dreams, to be delivered to him and nobody else.
"Who is this gentleman? He dupes you, that is certain. This is the language of a mountebank. Make no mistake."
"I trust him implicitly," Mr. Hancock bridles. "This creature is genuine, there is no doubt, and it will be yours."
"Why would I want it now? This affair has quite ruined my appetite for mermaids."
Angelica gazes again across her denuded apartment, but catching sight of Mr. Hancock's face, which is all at once utterly disconsolate, she is contrite.
"Well, I don't care."
She sniffs hard and sets about raking her fingers through her hair until she looks altogether more herself. Her skin has lost its patchy look, and her eyes, although red-rimmed still, are bright and lively.
"The very thing I asked of you, you have delivered to me, although I had thought it impossible."
She squeezes his hand. Her fingers are damp and hot. Then her bottom lip wobbles apparently without her bidding, and she chokes out,
"Take me away from here, I beg of you."
"Yes, indeed, you must come home with me," he says,
then hesitates.
"Do you know that my house is not grand? It is not at all like your current situation."
My current situation? What do I have? What part of it was ever mine? Please, please, if you're certain you would have me, I do not care where you will take me.
Mrs. Frost and Mrs. Chapel return, their arms full of goose-feather pillows. They incline their heads to Mr. Hancock. Angelica shoots a glance at them, but remains on her knees, clutching Mr. Hancock's hand.
"I have one request," she says, "but it is an important one."
"Go on."
She shoots a glance at her erstwhile friends, who stand in perturbation and disgust.
"I need you to marry me."
Volume 3. Chapter 1. February 1786.
"Not possible,"
snaps Hester Lippard, who is wearing out the wheels of her carriage she must so often fly to her brother's house. She has not so much as removed her cape upon striding through his door, and remains immovable in the hall, which in-between place strikes him as a very unsatisfactory sight for a row.
"She'll not live here."
Mr. Hancock is in jovial spirits, not easily damped.
"Good afternoon, sister. How do you today?"
"Oh, not a grain of contrition. I never had you for a rake, sir, but you have not only taken a whore, you have brought her under this roof and now lavish her with Hancock money."
She looks about herself, seeking evidence of his debauch, an abandoned garter, perhaps, or a brimming punch bowl.
"Fresh paint, do I smell?"
"We have undertaken some improvements."
"Oh, she has got her feet under the table. What liberty to take with a house that is not even her own."
She is such a conduit of rage, it is a wonder she does not catch a light.
"'Tis my house," he says mildly.
"Our father's! Our grandfather's! What are you thinking, to bring such a serpent into the nest? I suppose you would have Suki ruined. That matters nothing to you."
"There will be no ruination," he says.
"You will ruin us all,"
she pronounces with relish.
"Sister, you are not dependent on me."
"I cannot hold my head up in society. I cannot. You go from bad to worse. Do you think Mr. Lippard's clients do not mark it? He acquires a sideshow one day, a mistress the next. What sort of family do you come from, Mrs. Lippard? That is what they ask of me. Furthermore, the Lady R. William has been working on these last 6 months at considerable personal expense. Has turned very cool towards him, indeed, and I cannot but suspect that this is as a direct result of your conduct. And you know William's troubles in catching the eye of any lady, let alone one with 200 a year settled on her. If she does not accept him after all this, the blame will be on you."
"So be it," he says.
"I beg your pardon?"
"If that is how you will have it, I cannot help it."
"Oh! You're not one bit sorry. What has got into you?"
Angelica is upstairs in the bedroom, pinning closed the bodice of her plain, rust-coloured gown, Bridget having quit her to answer the door. She has been in the house only 10 days, but she has already overseen the repainting of the dark bedroom panelling and replaced the curtains and the hangings of the ancient bed with new ones of shining moreen. Fine, to be sure, but not extravagant. In the shadow of growing ships, she is in the midst of a sort of convalescence, sleeping early and long, and eating plain and honest foods, like an invalid or a little child. Her dress is neat, her countenance natural. She lives very quiet and blameless in this sturdy, ship-built house. Nothing is as grand as she has been accustomed to, but none of it can be taken from her. Sometimes she walks from room to room, touching the panelled walls, the heavy furniture, the walled glass in the windows. She touches them lightly with the tips of her fingers and thinks, "This is mine, and this, and this." She may walk from her parlour, she has had it done in almond green, into Mr. Hancock's counting-house any time it pleases her, and see his strong box and his ledgers and his own buff-coloured back hunched over his desk. And although he does not make her feel the way certain other men have, it is sufficient that he is pleased by her. He wishes her there. He has chosen her as part of his home. The querulous agitation of her time in London has almost fallen away from her now. She has not felt moved to write to her friends, and she is grateful to have heard nothing from them. From two flights below, she hears the hectoring tones of a woman's voice, and is in no doubt as to whom it might belong. She has not yet met Mrs. Lippard, but from Mr. Hancock's description and Suki Lippard's demeanour, she has surmised precisely what sort of woman she is.
"Suki!"
Mrs. Lippard barks.
"Susanna!"
And Angelica hears her stir in the parlour below.
"I shall go down too," she thinks to herself, "and make myself agreeable to this lady."
She fluffs her hair and ties her apron and proceeds downstairs. Suki is coming onto the landing, book in hand.
"Is that your mother?"
Angelica asks.
"How did you guess? Will you come down to meet her?"
Angelica is not yet decided about Suki, and principally because Suki seems not yet decided about her. She finds she can do nothing in the girl's presence without scrutiny. Whatever she gleans from watching this newcomer butter a roll or read a book, shake the dust from her cape or close the shutters, she voices none of it. There is no mistaking she has seen more than Angelica had intended to show her, and this is discomforting.
"What have you told her about me?"
she ventures now. Suki walks before her down the stairs. Angelica cannot see her expression.
I don't tell her a thing."
"Suki!"
Hester Lippard stands at the foot of the stairs.
"You condescend to join us?"
"I was in the parlour," says Suki. "The fire is burning. Why do you not come up?"
"Oh, may I? Dare I? It's not her house now?"
As Angelica comes into sight, she turns back to Mr. Hancock.
"This is your jade? All these years you resist the expense and trouble of bringing a wife into the house, and yet you will install a mistress?"
"She is not my mistress," says Mr. Hancock. "She is my wife."
Angelica has never seen the blood leave a person's face with such rapidity. Mrs. Lippard, in the first place less than ruddy, becomes positively green.
"You are not serious," she whispers.
Angelica descends the last few steps with her arms outstretched.
"Good afternoon, sister," she cries. "I rejoice in calling you my relation. I've heard so much about you, and it seems that it's all perfectly true."
Hester is not so numb as to demur a response.
"You're not much like your picture, but then you are clothed."
Angelica knows about women and their empire building. She knows also that a woman in perfect control of her fate never resorts to rudeness, and this gives her a small glow of satisfaction. She clasps Mrs. Lippard's hand and smiles her most honeyed of smiles. Suki is dumbstruck. She can only snigger with shock.
"I do not know what you are laughing for," says her mother. "'Tis your portion he's throwing away, all the fortune your grandfather spent so long building up, and we shall never see any of it once she is done."
"I have made a great deal of money on my own account lately," interjects Mr. Hancock.
"Whatever you make, she'll spend double,"
snaps Mrs. Lippard, and returns at once to her interrogation.
"Married when? How can this be?"
3 days ago, quietly, before breakfast.
Oh, this is too much. A legal marriage?
I don't think so. No banns were read. I'd have heard of it at once.
Oh, interjects Angelica. We wed by licence. So much faster. And how vulgar to have one's private business broadcast for gossip.
Proud, are you, to have private business not fit to be spoken of in church?
Hester returns her attention to Mr. Hancock.
So she snared you, well and truly, paying honest money to rush this wedding through. I suppose you did not pause to wonder how many husbands this whore may already have.
Will you stand for that? His wife demands. You'll let her offend my honour so?
All the women stare at him, Suki quite rapt, echoed by the half of Bridget's face peeping round the kitchen door. Hester and Angelica, twins of female affront. He has been afraid of Hester's wrath since infancy, but that of his new wife is yet untested. Her eyes have a virago flash to them. Her hair seems to puff itself larger, her skirts prickle. Hester, seeing his hesitation, warms to her theme.
Where is her bridal portion? How is she a help meet when she brings you only debts? And you will raise up the bastard children you get on her from your pocket alone? How will...
He has heard quite enough.
No, I'll not stand for it, he snaps. Mrs. Lippard... You dishonour my wife. It will not do.
Oh, I like that. I dishonour her?
Hester affects to reel in shock. Angelica claps her hands and clasps them under her chin.
And yourself, too,
says Mr. Hancock, spurred on by his wife's pleasure,
speaking so rudely of a lady who has welcomed you into her home.
A vein in Mrs. Lippard's temple is twitching.
So be it. If you won't eject this woman from the house, I have no choice but to remove my daughter from it.
The entire company gasps.
Now, Hester, there's no need for that.
Come, Suki,
says Mrs. Lippard, as if he never spoke at all, making to seize her daughter's arm.
I'm taking you home.
Suki lets out a little shriek, and breaking free, scampers back up the staircase. Mrs. Lippard turns to Mr. Hancock.
She'll stay not a minute longer. I'll have no daughter of mine in so poisonous an environment.
She does not want to go, says Angelica,
but Mrs. Lippard sets off up the stairs in pursuit of her daughter. A great clattering and scuffling ensues as Suki ascends further. Their skirts may be seen flapping between the banisters.
Christ!
Angelica pats about her person for her fan. Finding that she has none, she wafts herself with her hands.
I had expected a quieter life for myself.
Upstairs, mother and daughter can be heard squabbling furiously.
Well?
Mr. Hancock remains where he is, frozen, it seems.
Are you going to settle this?
This is not for me to meddle in.
Meddling? You are the man, are you not? Your word will settle this.
He looks at her helplessly.
Let her have what she wants.
And what about you?
Hush.
He squirms in his awkwardness.
I'd not lose Suki for anything. But my sister is not to be reasoned with at moments such as these. Far better to give her what she wants and retrieve the child another day.
I do not believe that can be the solution.
Down the stairs comes Mrs. Lippard and Suki weeping beside her.
Say something,
hisses Angelica, but her husband tugs at his stock and utters not a word.
Suki,
Mrs. Lippard sings out.
Mark this. He has chose the whore over his own flesh and blood. "'Tis hardly to be credited, but there it is.'
"'Young Suki looks crushed as a lawn cap after a day at Bartholomew Fair. "'She cups her hands over her face.
"'D-
Do not let her take me away, she says. Oh, Uncle, tell her no.
Bridget cannot restrain herself from bursting from the kitchen and forcing herself past her master into the midst of the scene. The girls cling to one another and lament in harmony, while Hester Lippard hauls dauntlessly at her daughter's arm.
Uncle! Uncle, do not let her!
Suki weeps. But it is Angelica who steps forward.
Stop!
She says in a tone of great command.
Stop now and listen to me.
Mrs. Lippard, affronted, turns to her. Suki's spasmodic gasps are all that can be heard.
What do you want?
Asks Angelica.
Why, to preserve my daughter's virtue.
That ain't in question.
I don't believe you. Besides, it is how things look.
Aye, appearances are everything. So how can we improve hers?
Angelica glances at her husband.
Society is wont to overlook all sorts of failings and peculiarities where money is involved.
What are you suggesting?
He asks sternly.
I should like to know,
says Mrs. Lippard.
Well, what is settled on her future at the moment? Do not tell me. You have, what, 6 other daughters? I expect they have already had the lion's share of what even the most dedicated of parents can afford to put by.
Her prospects are not as good as our eldest's were,
Hester Lippard admits. Angelica shakes her head.
And their husbands, I suppose, deplete your fortune by asking for more investment.
How can we refuse when they have our daughters, our grandchildren to support?
Laments Hester.
Young men today manage their money very ill indeed.
And so what will be left for your Suki?
Asks Angelica.
The future of the youngest child is always so tenuous, so vulnerable to fate's caprice. I cannot imagine your guilt and trepidation.
But my brother has always sworn he will put in for her.
Aye, and that he will.
Angelica smiles with beatific cheer.
I will make sure of it. I give you my word. In fact, I can vouch for...
Mrs. Hancock,
he warns her. He is shy of Angelica's lavish bent. What might she promise on his behalf?
Well, I feel sure we can come to a very satisfactory agreement. Come, Mrs. Lippard, shall we talk this out properly upstairs? You've been on your feet so long, it is time to sit down and take some refreshment at least. Bridget,
she perks an eyebrow at the girl, whose face is still buried in Suki's shoulder.
Biscuits, if you please, and hot water to the parlour. Sister, would you follow me?
And in the almond-green-painted parlour, at the brand-new tea-table with its pristine little tea-bowls, these ill-matched sisters-in-law talk out every possible inch of Suki's bridal portion and her illustrious future, while Mr. Hancock sits by with his books and his pipe, nodding to their requests or drawing his brow into a frown as he scratches out more numbers. Mrs. Lippard laments her woes, and Mrs. Hancock soothes her.
Oh, I know, a dreadful state of affairs. How have you borne it so long? But this generation is so different. I'd never have had your patience, Mrs. Lippard. Certainly I would not.
Once they are finished, it is agreed that Suki Lippard will be a great deal richer than she had ever hoped to be.
As to her education, says Angelica,
"'Tis done,' says Mrs. Lippard. "'Her school could do no more for her.'
"'I learnt nothing,'
growls Suki.
"'You read every book they had.'
"'If I'd known they were so few, I would have read slower.'
"'Well, book learning is not very useful,' says Angelica,
"'and easily faked when the effect is required. I thought more that I would engage a dance master. Her deportment, Mrs. Lippard, shows promise. I feel her walking and general grace of movement could come on considerably with very little encouragement. And a singing teacher, too, and let us not have her neglect her pianoforte, for that is where so many girls betray their lack of polish. One always wants a Frenchman for music lessons. Leave that to me. Leave that to me. I know people.
She leans back in her chair, eyes bright.
Is your mind any more at ease?
Hester Lippard has begun to convince herself of the advantages to keeping Suki in her brother's house. To be sure, the girl has plenty more to learn, and Mrs. Lippard has not the time to teach it all to her. And she hates to see any child of hers underemployed when there is work for them elsewhere, and what would she do with Suki under her feet in Southwark? And she has not even considered yet the expense of laying another place at the table when she already has sons and daughters-in-law and apprentices and servants to feed.
But her moral education, her spiritual well-being, she hazards, the child's soul.
Fortuitous, we are so well placed for two churches, not to mention our Quaker brethren. And I declare I never knew such an infestation of non-con-tub-thumpers as I find here. Her soul will be spoilt for choices.
And you?
Even now, Angelica does not lose her composure. She tips her head and smiles.
I understand your concern, Mrs. Lippard, but look at me.
She gestures to her plain gown, her unpowdered hair, her entire cleanliness and delicacy.
Trust your eyes, madam. You see, I am not so unlike you. And even a Magdalene can be redeemed. Say, that will be a fine lesson for her soul.
Mrs. Lippard, looking at her obediently, is filled with suspicion. But then she is suspicious also of many of the women she knows. And if Suki were to be removed from this house, her means of intelligence would be vastly diminished. Yes, it is better to arm oneself with knowledge. Suki is hardly in harm's way. She is not starved or beaten. She has a room of her own and an opportunity for a comprehensive education. As for what she might see or hear in the home of a renowned harlot,
well, children are robust. When one tops it all up, it would be the crueler thing to deny her this opportunity.
Mrs. Lippard concludes that her daughter has the moral integrity to withstand temptation and debauch. One might even consider it a test. If she falls, well, that is an indictment on her inborn moral weakness, from which nobody could save her.
"She'll stay," she says. "But if I hear one thing that is not to my liking..."
"You will not," Angelica assures her. "We are a family of scrupulous morals. You will not regret this, madam. We will make a triumph of the child."
Mr. Hancock is somewhat surprised by his niece's subsequent demeanour towards him. He has never been so out of Suki's books before, and is chilled by the glower she fixes upon him before retiring to her window-seat, never to speak again all evening.
"She thinks I did not stand up enough for her," he frets.
He tries to broach the subject with a jovial nudge in the ribs.
"Well, was all to the good in the end, eh?"
But she does not dignify him with any response at all.
"I wish she did not take it so hard,"
he says to Angelica when they're in their bedroom.
"She acts as if I threw her out."
"You responded very poorly indeed,"
says his wife, tucking her thickly plaited hair into her nightcap.
"I was positively ashamed."
She puts her hands on her hips, but there is no anger in her strictness, and her body most inviting where her chemise strains across it.
"You are not to go on in that manner any longer. You told me, before we married, that you were determined to protect Miss Suki. and have no misfortune befall her.
Aye, indeed I am.
You did not protect her today.
He sighs.
My sister is a remarkable difficult woman. If I give her her own way, that is not to say I have capitulated to her.
Hark at yourself.
She climbs into bed beside him, and after a moment he turns to her admiringly.
Indeed, Mrs. Hancock, you may affect all sorts of things that I, a man, may not.
Ha! And think what you may do that I may not.
You have a delicacy to you that I cannot emulate, and an understanding. I did not see Mrs. Lippard so placid as she was today in many years. I am glad to have you here.
Indeed, he thinks it becomes clearer by the day that he ought to have had a wife years ago. It seems to him that what they achieved together is much more than double what they might alone.
Oh, I'm accustomed to her sort, says Angelica. It is easy to please her. Everybody wants the same thing when it comes to it.
She bites her nail and wriggles deeper under the covers.
But she was right on one count, sir. You did choose me over Suki, and I wish you had not.
You are my wife, and she is not even my daughter. If her mother wished to remove her, what was I to do?
The child has been moved about according to convenience for years, I believe. She ought to have one place where she lives and is part of the household.
Soft-hearted, if there's work to be done in one house and she sits idle in another, where's the sense in it? Until she has a family of her own, she must make herself useful in this one.
But you are soft-hearted, says Angelica, nudging herself beneath the crook of his arm. I do not think you would be without her.
She will not confide in him that she needs Suki very much, that the girl knows a great deal about the running of a house, while she herself knows nothing at all.
But what of your promise to educate and refine her?
He scoffs.
An investment. The cleverer she is, the better she will marry.
Good returns, one day.
She's yawning now, her head a weight she is less inclined to hold up.
I shall find tutors for her.
He hesitates. The cat creeps from beneath the bed and springs up upon it. She wades across the bedclothes at their feet.
Not the same ones as teach Mrs. Chapel's charges?
He asks nervously. The cat is turning round in circles, kneading the counterpane, and Angelica feels the spirit of Belle Fortescue rise up in her.
Ain't it all to the same end?
Instead, she shakes her head.
You've nothing to fear, sir. Here.
And rolling over, turns her face frankly to his.
You did a fine thing today. You defended your household. Eventually. Is that not an auspicious beginning to our marriage?
This she means most sincerely. It is a novelty and a relief that the man who now keeps her refuses to deny her. She could not have borne another turncoat of Rockingham's sort. She clasps his hand above the covers and pats it gently. They smile at one another, the very picture of mercantile happiness.
Let us waste no more of the candle, she says.
Chapter 2. March 1786. It happens that a gentleman named Mr. Brierly is one day caught in flagrante with his horse-boy, or some say his horse, but either way such prurient interest in the dealings of strangers has no place in this story. It only signifies at all because, after this, Mr. Brierly hanged himself, the extent of his debts were revealed, and his widow put his house and all its contents up for sale for a very reasonable price. This news catches the ear of Mr. Hancock as he goes about his business one morning.
"I shall buy it for you,"
he says to his wife at breakfast.
"Oh, no," she says, "not on my account, not for me."
She is remarkable pretty, he thinks, pink-cheeked and plump and comfortable in her sprigged white morning dress, and her habits are pretty too, for after his morning's work she has him join her in her bedroom at 10 or 11 for tea and hot rolls. He sits gingerly on one of the spindly chairs she has had brought in, with his legs splayed out one on either side of the tiny round table, and holds his tea-bowl between finger and thumb, while Angelica, not long out of bed, helps herself to butter and marmalade. Breakfast is a novelty for her, she rarely having risen before noon in her old life, and he likes to watch the seriousness with which she eats warm bread and cold preserves.
"I promised you better," he says. "I did not mean you to live in Deptford."
"Well,
I am content." And for Suki,
who has not joined them, who is still, in fact, surly about him,
"we must increase her opportunities to meet fine people and cultivate herself."
Privately, he is anxious that now her head has been turned with Angelica's promise of dancing lessons and French tutors, his niece will be satisfied with nothing less. He furthermore feels a certain guilt that he did not think to offer her such things himself.
"We can do better," he says,
"and we ought.
I am not what I was, Mrs. Hancock. I'm a landowner now, and a landlord. My properties in Marylebone go up at such a pace that I may soon remove myself from the business of the city entirely." "'Tis absurd," he persists, "for a man of my fortune to continue to live in a house like this, and more so now with a wife such as you. Every day I look at you sitting by the fire, and I say to myself, a beautiful gem needs a beautiful setting."
"Oh, go on with you. I told you, I'm perfectly content."
"Contentment is a start," says Mr. Hancock, "but I shall make you happy. I shall give you everything you want."
"There is no such thing."
She's buttering another roll.
"There is always more to want."
He is not sure what to reply. He smiles with his mouth half open like a big dog, confused by its mistress's command. He waits amiably for her to say something more intelligible.
"And how can I believe a thing you say," she teases, "when you have never yet produced the mermaid you promised me?"
"You are impatient. The mermaid is impending. It is being brought home aboard the Unicorn."
"And where is the Unicorn now?"
"Unaccounted for," he admits, "but this is not concerning. It was an unusual voyage for Jones. He must be on the home stretch by now."
He must be, else where could he have got to?
"Mermaids wreck ships," she says.
"Don't say such things,"
snaps Mr. Hancock, rapping hard on the table. "Even in jest."
"Oh, don't look at me so, you great thing. So I never had my mermaid. Well, I never was Queen of France either, and yet here we are doing quite well for ourselves. That ship will come safely home, and whether it has a mermaid on board or no, it hardly signifies. I have married you, after all. You buy a house, sir, if you wish, and I shall come with you and be very happy in it, I am sure." "Sure? I've never been surer," he says, perking up. "I think you underestimate how much you will like it."
She raises a hand to quiet him. Butter glistens on her wrist. She is frightened by strong emotion. The word happiness frightens her, the way love does. She wants nothing so volatile.
"We must live within our means," she says.
"That ain't for you to worry about."
"Please, Mr. Hancock, do not get into debt. I've no need for grandeur."